Well, any patient who's hormone receptor positive to me is a candidate for hormonal therapy up front, except for patients with visceral crisis. And visceral crisis would be defined as patients who have widespread liver metastases, lymphangitic lung disease, or if they're having significant problems with pleural effusion that have to have numerous thoracentesis, et cetera, something that needs very rapid action. And there I would move to chemotherapy first, and even if it was a HER2-positive patient, I probably would use chemotherapy plus trastuzumab as opposed to single-agent trastuzumab. For the average patient who does not have visceral crisis, I would use hormonal therapy up front, whether they are HER2-positive or HER2-negative. It's not controversial. I shouldn't think it would be controversial for the patient who is HER2-negative, because hormonal therapy is the mainstay of treatment for the vast majority of patients for metastatic breast cancer. For patients who are HER2-positive, there are those who feel that a combination of hormonal therapy and trastuzumab should be given up front. I do not fall into that camp as yet. I know that Denny Slaman feels that way. I know that Steve Jones feels that way. And I don't know among the other major U.S. opinion leaders how many would fall into the camp of using combination hormonal therapy and trastuzumab together at this point in time.
It's going to be interesting to see how that changes over time. I think the minority of people have done that. But now we have the experience that I want to ask you about in terms of the adjuvant trastuzumab studies. And in those studies, half of those patients had ER-positive tumors. And basically, they all got hormone therapy and trastuzumab together. Granted, it was in the adjuvant setting.
Correct. I don't extrapolate from the adjuvant setting to the metastatic disease setting because our therapeutic goals are different. Our therapeutic goals are cure in the adjuvant setting. Our therapeutic goals are palliation and prolongation of life. And to me, every manipulation that we have in metastatic disease is gold. And if we're using a combination of a hormone and trastuzumab, both of which are relatively non-toxic, and you get a two-year response, what do you know? You really don't yet know too much, because what would happen if you had given those agents sequentially? We're still arguing that point in the chemotherapy arena on the basis of the two phase three chemotherapy trials that claim overall survival benefits. Yet those overall survival benefits were done without the benefit of having a sequential arm.
You're talking about the capecitabine docetaxel trial and the gemcitabine paclitaxel trials.
Correct.
Getting back to hormonal therapy in metastatic disease, how do you approach the sequencing of the available options, both in the postmenopausal and premenopausal patient?
Well, in postmenopausal patients, for the most part, I still would probably start with an aromatase inhibitor. And I have a slide that I generally show in most of my talks of the nine lines of hormonal therapy for postmenopausal women. You can just run down them, and there is no tried and true sequence. And so we don't have any consensus of a true hormonal cascade. If one starts with an AI, one could then go to, let's say one starts with a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor, one can then go to a SERM like tamoxifen, or one could go to Faslodex, and then you could go to a steroidal aromatase inhibitor, and then you can go to high-dose estrogens, and then you could always go back to a SERM as another option. You still have megestrol acetate and testosterone, you know, such as halotestin, in reserve. And so you can manipulate hormones sometimes in some women for years. And I've had women on hormonal therapy for 10 or 12 years before ever reaching cytotoxic chemotherapy.
You mentioned high-dose estrogen. How do you use that right now? What kind of preparation and dose?
Well, for a while, I was sending my patients to the veterinarian because diethylstilbestrol was taken off the market, but the vets still have it, but only at the 1 milligram dose. So in order to get the 15 milligrams per day of DES, they'd have to take 15 tablets, and you'd have to send them to the veterinarian, which sounded kind of weird. But there are compounding pharmacies who would make diethylstilbestrol, and it is legal, and I have provided them with letters of medical necessity. And what Matt Ellis does, and Matt actually has an NIH grant to look at high-dose estrogens again, or relook at it again, and the dose that he uses is ethinyl estradiol at 2 milligram tablets, and he uses 5 tablets 3 times a day, or 30 milligrams per day of ethinyl estradiol. And we've had probably as many responses to high-dose estrogens in patients who have failed 3 or 4 hormones previously as we've had to Faslodex in the same clinical situation. But that's not a head-to-head comparison. It's not a controlled randomized trial. But just to say that we do have it, and I actually now have, I'm trying to make a slide of it, a woman with liver metastases where we've now been able, on high-dose estrogens, to show an actual partial response and visualize it with CAT scanning.
What have you seen in terms of tolerability of high-dose estrogens? I know in the past it's been a little bit challenging in terms of nausea, vomiting, thrombosis.
We really haven't had that much problem with it. In fact, 2 anecdotal experiences of postmenopausal women where they have said that they don't know if it's working or not, but their sex life has improved dramatically. And even though libido is supposed to be linked to testosterone, a couple of our patients on high-dose estrogens have commented upon a dramatic increase in libido.
That's interesting. You're the second person who's mentioned that to me. Has that been documented in the literature?
I don't know.
Well, a case series of 2.